Blog Talk Radio.
I've tried a thousand times to break down my door, and I've lied a thousand lies to try to get beyond these walls and chains that bind and hold me to the ground. I've cried a thousand cries, but no one hears a sound. I'm so tired, oh my life.
Good evening and welcome to Spotlight for Justice, a podcast by the National Women's Coalition Against Violence and Exploitation. I'm your host, Michelle Bart, and joining me is my co-host, Dr. Kathy Mathis. Tonight, our guest is a real-life working crime scene investigator for Metro Atlanta Police Department. Cheryl Mack McCollum is a National Law Enforcement Officer Hall of Fame inductee, director of the Cold Case Investigative Research Institute, a writer for Crime Online, forensic and crime scene expert for Crime Stories with Nancy Grace, and is co-author, Cold Case, Pathways to Justice. Cheryl holds a master's degree in criminal justice with an emphasis on policing. She is going to take your calls this evening on Spotlight for Justice. The call-in number is 515-602-9601. Let's welcome our guests, Dr. Kathy Mathis and Cheryl McCollum. Welcome, Mac.
Thank you so much. I've been looking so forward to talking to y'all.
Well, welcome, welcome. You're on the East Coast and we're on the West Coast. So how is it on the East Coast right now at 8 p.m.?
Still hot.
Hot and humid, huh?
Beautiful. It's hot and humid, but it is beautiful and a clear night.
Well, welcome. So you just came off of CrimeCon, correct?
It'll be next week.
Oh, next week. Okay.
There.
Can you tell, that's in Orlando, correct?
It is this year, yes.
Okay. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and mm-hmm. how you became known as the celebrity of CrimeCon?
Well, I will tell you everything I know. So I've worked cold cases for the past 20 years through the Cold Case Investigative Research Institute. So through the institute, we've worked, you know, hundreds of cases, many high profile, some you've never heard of, but they're locally known. And so when I was first approached about speaking at CrimeCon their first year, I did not know what it was. I was somewhat familiar with, like, Comic-Con, and so when they said CrimeCon, I was like, do people dress up like serial killers? Like, I don't know if that's really my cup of tea. And they were like, no, not at all. You know, where, you know, practitioners and victims and law enforcement and different people can all come together and highlight and showcase cases, some that have gotten tons of publicity, some that haven't gotten what they needed. You know, so it's kind of everybody thinking of ways to move these cases along, and it's a place where we can all meet. So instead of just watching Nancy Grace on TV or Kelly Ziegler on Cold Justice, you can literally sit there and talk to them and, you know, share ideas or tell them what you love about their shows or, you know, just being supportive of one another and helping move these cases forward.
It is a shame that so many cases do go cold. What got you involved with doing this? And I know that you have a master's degree with the emphasis mm-hmm. on policing, et cetera. But what made you want to go into this field? In the 80s, when women were not really going into this line of work.
Sure. I have always been fascinated by crime, even as a little girl. And many people have heard this story, but I will tell it again. My mother was a fantastic storyteller. And when I was little, my sisters were all older than I am. And when you got about 100 miles out of Atlanta, the radio wouldn't work anymore. You know, you'd be too far out to get a signal. And, you know, there wasn't any really way to entertain five girls once it got dark. So she would tell us stories. Well, when I was four, I got captivated by the way she told the story of Bonnie and Clyde. Now, she only told it as they were in love, you know, madly in love, crisscrossing the United States, robbing banks. I didn't know anything, of course, about the violence and the killing and all that that came later, but I just, as a little kid, thought, I don't know why you and Daddy aren't doing that. Like, why are we broke? You know, y'all love each other. Rob a bank. So as I learned more and, you know, I started to read, and I would read about Al Capone and John Dillinger. Well, when I was about 8 years old, they took me to see the Bonnie and Clyde car, and that just kind of fueled it even more. And then when I was 12, they took me to Alcatraz, and it just went from there. So I've always wanted to be in criminal justice, even though I really didn't know what criminal justice was, and I've kind of always gravitated toward jobs that didn't even exist at the time.
Wow. Bonnie and Clyde is much different than where we're at today in the 21st century with the internet, the dark mm-hmm. web, and how people really believe that they can get away with crime. Sometimes it appears that way. But then there's other times that we extradite folks, like with Natalie Holloway's case. That was one of yours, mm-hmm. correct?
Correct. I started working with Beth in 2005, and she, I tell you, Aruba was counting on a lot of things. They were counting on the fact that nobody would have the money to stay and do their own investigation. They were counting on somebody that would not be connected to people that would come there and have resources and technology and know-how. They were counting on a whole lot, but, honey, they weren't counting on Beth Holloway. Beth did things in her trauma and in her just chaotic state that were extraordinary. And one of the mm-hmm. things she did almost immediately when she landed in Aruba is she went to the home of Johan Vandersloot. Called them out immediately. Well, a lot of people wouldn't have done that. A lot of people wouldn't have already got a statement from him that now he's either got to backtrack from or change. Well, as you know, he's changed his statement repeatedly, and he's confessed repeatedly in different ways. Your understanding of Aruba is very different than the Aruba once you get there. And if any of your folks have ever visited that island, there are parts that are as stunning as anything I've ever seen. The waves crashing on those big rocks right at the lighthouse is spectacular. The calm, really beautiful water out in front of some of the resorts. I mean, you could just stay there the rest of your life. The interesting thing about Aruba, it's not a tropical island, even though that's the way they present. But every flower that is blooming that is on that island, they brought in. Every palm tree they brought in. It's really an arid, almost desert island. It's got lizards and things like that, but the picturesque part and the flowers and things they brought in will fool you. From where it is just perfect at the resort, literally one street away, not even a solid block, just one little street, is run down, dilapidated, drug infested. So when they were telling Beth things like, She's probably just been taken. When they get done with her, you'll just see her walking down the street. They've probably just drugged her. When they're finished with her, they'll let her go. Well, that tells you their understanding of that island and their acceptance of crime on that island. So when Aruba tells you, we've never had a murder, we've never had any issue, is that true? Well, I don't think it's true. I think we all know they've had at least one murder.
Yeah, right?
She was, quote, yeah, and since she was, quote, never found, they still list her as missing.
I would like to ask you about that. Because that mm-hmm. island is not so big, you know, it's not a large island, so to speak, and to not be able to find a person's body, what are some of the circumstances that, in your experience and knowledge base, goes into someone, you know, someone being able to hide a body on a small island like that? You know, I know some of the speculation was, you know, he burned her, he, you know, put her out with weights on the body, and you know, that kind of thing. But. You know, those are all just things as speculations of different things different reporters said on the news and things like that. So from a CSI perspective, what would be some of the things that would come to your mind as what possibly could have happened to her as to why she can't be found?
I'll tell you exactly what I told Beth Holloway in 2005. She's in the Atlantic Ocean. She's never going to surface, and here's why. In Aruba, they have what's called the Caribbean Wall. So if you're there, you can walk out into the water. It's knee-deep for a long time. So it's not like if you go to Daytona or somewhere like that where you walk out and all of a sudden it just drops 6 feet or 12 feet and it gets, you know, deeper pretty quick. Aruba's not like that. And then once you hit that Caribbean Wall, it drops like 75 feet. With the shark and turtle activity, if she had been dumped past that Caribbean Wall, started to float at all, the animal activity would have taken care of that, sadly, tragically. There's nothing to float to the top.
Yeah.
You know, another case that we've seen where ocean waters were the factor was Natalie Wood. Did you do anything on that case?
I sure did. So I worked with her sister. I worked with the original captain of the ship. And ironically, my daughter is the exact same size as Natalie Wood. So when they first sent deputies out to the yacht, all of these gentlemen were 6'1", 6'2", 6'3", in that range. Well, they can't objectively, with any certainty, go from that boat into a dinghy because they can step right on it. I knew my daughter Caroline was not going to be able to. She's too little. So she would have had to have jumped. That's the first thing. The second thing is Natalie would have never done that side of water. She would not swim in her own pool. So the fact that she's going to jump from a yacht into a dinghy in ocean water where both of these vessels are moving is ludicrous. Here's the other thing, and I will give y'all a little test. You can type in Natalie Wood, movie actress, and hit images. I dare you to find me a picture that is not flawless. Even when she's at her mailbox, even when she's sitting on the side of her pool, even when she's in between takes or at the grocery store, she looks incredible. Natalie was super aware that the public wanted to see Natalie Wood. So when you read in that report that she was wearing a nightgown, a flannel nightgown, and wool socks, there ain't no way she was headed to shore. None. Zero chance. Natalie would not have let the general public even know that she owned a flannel nightgown. And gotcha. Most people don't know she went to shore the night before because that's when the fighting started. and she got the captain to drive her in the dinghy and stay with her that night. He slept on the floor in the hotel, and then she went back the next day thinking, okay, the dust is settled, it'll be fine.
So what do you think, what do you think happened in that case?
I think it was an accident. I think when you look at the injury to her face and then where the other injuries are on her wrist, on her legs, and then you have somebody that does a medical examiner's report that said, oh, she injured her ankle trying to re-enter the dinghy. Okay, the dinghy was away from the boat. It had been, the rope was undone, right? That dinghy was filled with air. This was not a metal rowboat. That dinghy, once it was off on its own, the wind takes care of that thing. She would no more have been able to hang on to that dinghy and kick her leg up with that thing moving. All she would be able to do was hang on to that rope. There were no burns or injuries to the palms of her hands.
Wow.
So that doesn't make sense. Here's another thing that doesn't make any sense. Robert Wagner went all over that boat. He went up to the captain, have you seen her? Help me look for her. Went here, went where they had dinner, went back to their bedroom. You know where he never went? Their guest bedroom. Walken was
Why
on that
you
ship.
Think?
Because he knew where she wasn't. He wasn't really having to look for her.
Gotcha.
Because if you thought that she was actually having an affair with Christopher Walken, wouldn't you kick that door in?
Yeah.
He didn't even do it. Why would he wait 4 hours to call the Coast Guard? And when he did, he simply said, someone's overboard. Someone?
Yeah.
In your panic, you don't just tell the truth?
Yeah. See, those are the little things. I'm sorry to interrupt. I was just going to say, those are some of the little things that the general public don't stop to think about, because, you know, we're thinking about, oh, somebody like him couldn't have done it. You know, that old, you know,
sure.
thing that comes from society of, well, nobody could be that bad, and yet we know that they're that bad and worse.
Sure. And here's the thing. Watch, there's video out there of Robert Wagner approaching Natalie's sister, Lana. Watch it and tell me. He's clenching his jaw. He's being very aggressive toward her. How dare you do this? How dare you do that? Okay, then explain these things so that she can understand it. You can't just say, I threw a glass bottle, which is different than what he originally said. He said there was so much wave activity that the wine glass must have just fallen off the shelf. Then later he admitted he threw it because he got mad at the relationship she was having with Christopher Walken, which was making a movie together. So, again, he wasn't hiding who he was in front of other actors. And remember, y'all, she divorced him before. So there was enough of a reason for her to pack everything she owned. Now, my husband always jokes that he can't divorce me because he's too lazy to pack. So you think about packing everything you have, being on the front page of Gossip magazine, meeting and marrying and having a child with somebody else, and then you come back to him. And then after that, you die tragically, and he won't explain it.
Yeah. I have another question to ask you, and thank you so much for that, because, you know, I'm a huge CSI fan, so, you know, and a Cold Justice show. I watch every one of the segments and things like that. I'm a wannabe forensic person, and so when these type of stories come up and cases come up, you mentioned something a few minutes ago when you were talking about the Natalie Holloway case about her mother. No, you know, they did not equate the family member factor into what can be done for their missing child or murdered child, that kind of thing. So I'd love for you to talk just a little bit about, you know, the results when you have a family member that is so tenacious, and even mm-hmm. if the case goes on for years unsolved, they will not let anybody forget about it. Would you talk just a little bit about that?
Absolutely. I'm going to say something that's not always real popular with law enforcement, but it's the truth. This is your case. This is your case, period. Now, you can't
Amen.
Do all the investigation, and you can't kick in doors, and you can't serve subpoenas, but it's your case. Nobody knows that victim better. Nobody understands the true victimology better. Nobody knows the background, the connections, the before and during and after. So you have to be involved. Now, listen to me very carefully. There are different personalities. I've got four sisters. Not all of them are going to throw the same type of party. Not all of them can give the same type of speech. One doesn't want to give a speech at all. The other could start a cult if she wanted to. So you have to get the truth. You need to get that family spokesperson. It ain't got to be mama if she can't do it, because there is some reality to, I can't get out of bed right now, and that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
But somebody you're connected to can, and that person needs to be the one knocking on doors, you know, stop saying this, stop saying that. And I'll give you a perfect example. Right now, one of the hot topics and buzzwords and things that people get all cattywampus about is sex workers, that title. In my world, now I want you to understand where I'm coming from. I do not have time to worry about if somebody is offended by what I say. I need something factual, and here's what I'm talking about. If somebody calls me and says, well, the victim was a sex worker, sadly, that's not enough information for me, because you have got somebody that could be a street-walking hooker or somebody that is a $10,000 a night call girl. What type of sex worker are we talking about? Because that's going to give me a suspect pool. Does that make sense?
Yes. All the sense in the world.
Okay. Okay. So sometimes, if people want to call me out because I use the word hooker, I'm being factual. And I'm trying to tell you something, not to disparage anybody. I don't care how anybody makes a living. I'm one of those people that don't think prostitutes should be charged with any crime. I think the only person that should be charged with a crime is the John.
Amen.
Absolutely.
That's me. So to me, it's like I own TV. That ain't a crime. You bust in my house and take it, that's a crime. That's how I see it. I do not know anybody personally, and I've worked with thousands. I do not know one sex worker that I've ever met personally that was not abused before she got in that job.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
So you have a victim of crime who turns to crime for survival, because that's what she was introduced to, and that's what she knows. So, again, stop with the title. Sex worker ain't no better. I'm just trying to tell you, there's not a pretty way to say it. There's not a glamorous way to say it. But you need to talk to me factually so I can find the person that hurt her.
You know, and that is very, very important. I train in human trafficking advocacy, and I certify people across the country in that. And I get, the attention of those that are offended by, the title. And I'm not in the business you are, but in the work that I do and in working very closely with these, survivors of, I ask them, what do you want me to call you? You know, it's like, some of them will say, call me a hoe. And I'll go, okay, if that's what you're comfortable with. But when I'm training people, they're outraged that I would even do that. And I said, listen, this is not about you and your,
inconsistencies in what offends you and what doesn't offend you, I ask that person, what are they comfortable with that I should call them? And I don't wait, oh, let me call up my friends and ask, is that politically correct? I'm not about that. It's about what is the information that you need, no matter whether it's your job, my job, or whoever's job, that person is okay. It, especially with me, because I'm working with them usually, you know, at the police department or they're brought to me out of the police department. But
sure.
I think we focus too much on those politically correct things rather than actually doing what we're supposed to be doing and focusing on a victim of crime.
Well, because, you know, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead, hon.
Oh, in my opinion, you know, we're a victim advocacy, national anti-violence organization with a very active missing children's division. And I can tell you that you have to meet the person, like Dr. Mathis and you said, where the person's at. And you have to, as a media consultant, I have to have my clients understand if your loved one is on drugs, suicidal, gay, you know, politically incorrect, or, you know, pregnant, mental illness, an escort, we have to address that from the get-go, or the public's not going to care to find them. And we find so many law enforcement agencies that tend, especially if it's a teenager, tend to use their biases in order to judge the character of the individual that's the victim that we're looking for. And we have to change that narrative. So when we get a case, we have to say, this individual may be suffering from a mental health crisis. They are also an escort, or they may be on Stark Street for survival sex. Put it out there. I've done it even for elected officials that I represented that had trafficking in their background. Let's throw it out there and get rid of that. So then that way, what is the news here? The news is this individual is innocent and they're missing. Anything else about that individual and or the family, for that matter, has no bearing on the fact that they didn't deserve what has happened or what will happen to them after they go missing. And if they're found deceased, as if like our case in Colorado Springs, Cara Nichols, my issue is the system failing the victims. So you come on to a case in order to understand the mindset, both of you actually, the understanding the mindset of the perpetrator in order to find the victim. Then once we find the victim and then we're in trial, then I see a system that fails the victims and their families, like in Cara's case being called it by the prosecutor. By the defense attorney. And so it's those kind of things that we do have to set the record straight, because we, all three of us, we represent the victim, and it doesn't matter what transpired or what caused whatever happened. There's only one person to blame, and that's the person that took their life.
Amen.
And so it, for us, you're preaching to the choir, Mac, because – the bottom line is there should be more people cloned like the three of us. And I will put that out there.
I like that.
Saying that, there are a couple cases that come to mind as far as cold cases. And I'm not sure if you've worked on any of them out there. But Haley Cummings,
okay.
That little girl's
yes.
face always comes to my mind, wondering what
mm-hmm.
happened to her, because we all were left to believe mom and dad were on drugs and she was eaten by alligators. What say you?
The babysitter knows exactly what happened to her. When you have a screen door type thing open and a brick propping it open, and she calls 911, and all she can focus on is, look at that brick, look at that thing holding the door open. She shouldn't even have noticed that. She should have been so panicked looking for that child. And then when she says things, and I'm working off memory, but she says things like, I've looked under the bed and everywhere. And then the police get there and the mattress is flat on the floor. To me, she should have been in handcuffs that night. Taken her down and they should have just hammered her. When you hear the 911 call of the dad where he's just cussing and carrying on and cussing and saying what he's going to do to everybody that, you know, took his baby, you're focused on the wrong thing. Number one, why do you think somebody's coming into your house and taking a six-year-old little girl? What drug dealer are you working with? Where has that happened in Florida ever, that the dad owed a drug dealer and they took a six-year-old girl? If the case is never, then he's so full of crap, again, he should be put in another room. And, to me, one of those deals where you just tell him, we're going to give one deal to one person. He's going to talk first. And I wouldn't talk to either one of them. I would take that 911 call and I'd go to work. And I would get the other child and I would get the other family members. And it would become pretty obvious pretty quick. Only one person and one person only had that child under their care and control. Only one person decided how they were going to search for this child. With the door propped open that you recognized and checking under the bed that wasn't possible and everything else. And that's the way it should have gone. They should have brought in statement analysts. They should have brought in heat seeking. They should have brought in dogs immediately. None of this should have been drug out like it was. This thing went on and on and on until they finally got them on drug charges. And, hey, a little prison is good, and they still, were doing the things they were doing. But that child deserved a whole lot more from everybody.
Well, I think so many cases that we see, especially if they make the media, it's amazing. I'll take Lindsay Baum's case here in McCleary, Washington. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I represented Melissa Baum in the beginning, and I had her ready for Jane Velez Mitchell's show, and followed by CNN, only to find that she's texting me and telling me, the FBI tells me every time I do an interview, it takes them away from looking for my daughter, so I'm not going to do this interview, Michelle. And she left the studio. And it's those little components that, okay, why are you telling parents that this is ruining opportunity to get the word out about where their missing daughter is? And that same week, that same time frame, Kyron Horman went missing. And Melissa called me crying, saying, why does he get, 30 billboards in different languages and Lindsay barely got one? Why does one case make a bigger difference in this world than all of the cases, since we have so many missing kiddos across this country?
Okay. Short answer is, I don't know. The longer answer is, there's some factors. And here's one analogy. How many people are going to get a record deal versus how many people can sing? You have these people that all of a sudden put this record out and they're just fabulous, right? So there's Ann Murray, there's Beyonce, there's these people. But then you get a show like The Voice and you're like, my Lord, that child deserves an album. Or that young man, I'd buy his record tonight. And they're nobodies. But they've got this talent that's unbelievable. The same principle. Sometimes there's just this magic thing where all the stars align, so to speak, and it's a hit. And sometimes it's the right photograph. Sometimes it's the right story. Sometimes it's the right spokesperson. And sometimes it's all the above. So when you have somebody, middle America, there's Natalie. Natalie Holloway is everybody's niece, everybody's favorite student, everybody's next-door neighbor. Everybody knows a Natalie. She's middle of the road, but she's really smart, and she's beautiful, and she's a cheerleader, and she's got a full ride to her hometown university, the University of Alabama, and her and her mama just went and were buying some dresses for her to go through Rush. Who doesn't understand her, right? And then you
right.
have friends
right.
who are like, she just went on a trip? I mean, all of us went on some type of senior trip. All of us have done stupid stuff. All of us have gotten in the wrong car with the wrong boy, but it didn't end up like that. Maybe we just got a hickey we couldn't hide. But what I'm saying is, for her, it was that story, and it connected with so many people. It connected with the 20-somethings who had just gone through it. It connected with every high school senior. It connected with every mama and aunt. So that's that story. Well, then sometimes you have a story that is so unbelievable, you can't not listen to it. And some of them write themselves, like Natalie Wood. How was that not going to be a story? But then you have stories that I think are equally as incredible, and y'all ain't never heard of it, like Tammy Jackson. Here Tammy lived in Savannah, Georgia, which most people know as this beautiful, historic city right on the river, and it's got everything. It's got intrigue. It's got mystery. It's got crime. It's got the best parties ever. It's got that little southern thing that people love to hear about, you know, moss and the white oaks and all of this. It's got everything. Horse-drawn carriages, got it. And Tammy is just this kid trying to find herself. She spends half her time acting like she's 12 and half her time like she's 30 because she's just turned 17. Just turned 17. So she's in that juxtaposition, right? Am I grown or am I a little kid? So, you know, she wants to be this lover of this grown man, but she likes Saturday morning cartoons and cereal. That's just her. So she disappears, but not for long. And they find her the very next morning, just after about 4 hours. She had been stabbed 130 times.
Oh, my gosh.
Hogtied, and then run over by a car on Hutchinson Island, Georgia. Hutchinson Island, even if you live in Savannah, don't know where it is. And it was just this deserted place where kids would go and hang out and party and make out. When they found her, the construction workers that were coming up there to some development, her body was still warm. Still
wow.
on fall.
Have they caught the person that did it?
No, it's still unsolved. And again,
oh
getting
God.
It out there would be helpful. Having people talk about it, because here's where I'm at. I disagree with the FBI on not putting it out there, and here's why. You've got a killer sitting at home watching the news, listening to the radio.
Mm-hmm.
First couple of days, you're talking about it all the time, and then nobody talks about it anymore. He got
then
away
they know
with
they
it.
Got away with it.
And he just starts going about his life. If you kept the pressure on where he had to think about it, they're still here. They're sending the FBI. They're canvassing. They're digging. They found something. They're going to test it. That's when he starts drinking and starts running his mouth.
Amen. Yep, like Joel Hollendorfer on our Kara Nichols case. So
yeah.
What's your take? Kyron Horman turned 21 this week. What's your take on Kyron's case?
I mean, I think some of the people that need to be under spotlight are right there. I mean, I don't think I disagree with anything that y'all will probably have already put out there, but I think in his case, again, children do not just disappear. They don't.
No,
they may be
children,
well-hidden.
Especially from elementary school.
Especially from elementary school. So if you've got somebody that was supposed to drop him off and or pick him up, that person does not come off my list until I find him, period. You
now,
can't
but then again, and like with that particular case, my whole thing is grand juries don't meet for 2 years. and the sheriff does not find a reason to bring in the person of interest in everyone's mindset, that tells
right.
me there's somebody else involved and you all had the wrong person.
Could be. You know, but again,
and you spent all this time on one person, so you've, and that was the largest case in history in Oregon. And so now you've spent all the resources on one case going after one person, and nothing ever happened to that one person. And now, hopefully, I hope and pray that someday he Googles his name or he sees his picture and he says, oh, wait, that's me.
Well,
because
here's the deal.
It's been a long time.
It's been a horrible long time, but here's how I feel. When you talk about spending resources and, you know, getting almost tapped out, I always remind people that what happened recently with Gabby Petito, we're
mm-hmm.
searching for her, but how many people did they recover? So here's the deal. We may be seeing some single focus, but some good work can still be being done. And that grand jury, you know, they can meet more than once. It could be in secret even, Georgia. So I say, again, the people that should be screaming the loudest, it's their case, and they need to do everything they can. There are ways, and y'all all know this, that we are now crowdfunding cases. There are people
mm-hmm.
that will donate every month to different cases. So there's not even a law enforcement agency that can anymore say it's not in our budget. That is not true. You've got, you know, people that have started entire organizations to give money. I mean, I have watched people be such generous benefactors that they have sponsored a case by themselves, just wrote a check. Then you've got, you know, folks like Seasons of Justice. I mean, my Lord, how many thousands and thousands of dollars have they given, and they've closed case after case after case? So, again, it takes all of us. And I always
mm-hmm.
say one of my mantras is every tool on every case, every time.
You've mentioned a couple times, and I fully agree with that. And again, it's really nice to know that there are these, you know, people that help fund. I wish that was the case for victims of domestic violence, because nobody cares about them because they figure they should have made better choices. And, you know, there's very few people out there helping them with their, you know, crimes against them. But you've mentioned a couple times as we've been talking so far that, and I love this, so I, you know I'm coming from a place where I'm in full agreement with you, because I work with perpetrators as well. And where these perpetrators think, first of all, that they're going to get away with something because they believe they're smarter than anybody else. And the tools that they use, I call it the squirrel effect, where they divert, they confuse,
mm-hmm.
they misdirect, they use smoke and mirrors, you know, to get people not focused on them, but other things and other people. So
mm-hmm.
in your work, I know, because I've been listening to you, that there are some qualities that make a good CSI who's working on these cases. So I have a couple, I have sort of like a question one, but followed up by a question two. So I would like you to tell our listeners and me, what are the most important tools that you consider an investigator should have? That's the first question. And then the second question is, once you have those tools, how do you go about getting hired by somebody to be a CSI agent? In case anybody is listening and this is their passion and they feel their purpose.
Okay. Well, I think there's a lot of things. And I'll just start with just as it comes to my mind, okay? One is something you cannot really learn or be trained, but that's common sense. If you have common sense, and I mean real common sense, that is a gift. And it's something that can be used and utilized in crime scenes. Number two, having a desire for justice, because that will keep you self-motivated, which is good. Like, you really want this bad guy off the street.
The other thing is to be open. And this is not something that you necessarily have to naturally come with, but you need to try to help teach yourself and train yourself. You can get just blinders on and miss some really obvious things if you're not looking. So if you walk into a scene and you've already made your mind up, oh, this is just a domestic, one of those type things, then you're going to make mistakes. So you need to look at it as an assault case and then work it as such, not just a domestic. Because, again, you may miss the check was ripped up or one of their photographs was ripped up and put in the trash can because you need to look at the trash can. Or when he tells you, I'm a preacher, and you accept it, which could be true, but you can't find no Bible in that house. So there's some common sense and there's some, you know, just dogged desire and then stay open. The other thing is, and this is something that's kind of fun, but you can start training yourself to be more observant. If you are naturally that way and you're a visual person, I fortunately am a visual person, but I've trained myself to be even better than I came that way, right? So look at a couple of tags in the parking lot when you go into the grocery store. See if you can remember when you come out. While you're in the grocery store, look at different buggies and try to ascertain things about that person. Are they single? Do they have children? Are they sick? Are they fixing to throw a party? Is somebody in trouble and he's only bought chocolates and flowers and champagne, but he doesn't look happy? You know, train yourself to start reading people, and then you can ask just a few questions. You can say, oh, those are beautiful flowers. Is it your anniversary? And he might, you know, nope, I screwed up. And then y'all can have a big laugh. Or you can say, whoa, 500 paper plates and a six-pack of Coke. You know, talk to people and then see whether or not you're right. Those are the kind of things that I do all the time. And my kids used to play games, and they would say, Mom, how many tags from different states were in the parking lot? 9. And then I can tell them Tennessee, North Dakota, California, North Carolina, South Carolina, Florida. I can tell them. And you get better and better and better at it. So start that now. The other thing, even if you do not have money for a college degree, and I want you to listen to me, you don't have to have a college degree. Take one
class. Say that once more. Say that once more for people who are listening.
You do not need a college degree, but here's a trick. Go take one class. Sign up for one forensic class. Forever and always, once you get your job, when you're sitting in front of that jury, they're going to ask you, what is your highest education level? And you can say, some college. You don't have to say a high school diploma. So now they're going to go, oh, she went to college. Like, all right, now she knows what she's talking about. If you get in a situation where you can scrape up a little bit more money, take another class. You might can get an associate's degree. So, again, don't worry about this. Well, I don't have $80,000. You don't need $80,000. It's just like it's illegal to run a red light. It is not illegal to stop on green. So figure out a way to boost that resume that's not going to make you broke. And then you might get on with a department that not only is going to send you to the police academy and train you and certify you, they may have an educational incentive where they'll pay for that bachelor's. Seek that out if that's something you want to do. But
that's really that's a perfect advice. We have about 10 minutes left, and I want to remind anyone listening, if you'd like to call in and ask Mac a question, the call-in number is 515-602-9601. Before we go to the last questions, I just want to ask about the case of Brittany Phillips. We're going to be in People magazine again on one of our cases, and her mother posted a comment that I asked you about. And we know we can't help everybody, but just tell our listeners a little bit about Brittany Phillips, because I was taken by the text wrapping of their vehicle on this particular case.
Her mama is a pistol. So when Brittany was murdered, she was 18 years old. She was smart, petite, beautiful. She got a full scholarship to go to school to study chemistry in California. She became terribly homesick, so she came back to Tulsa, got her first apartment. It was a second-story apartment, basically right across the street from her high school. She knew the area. Her mama felt pretty good about it because not too far from her was every teacher and coach and school resource officer that she knew if she kind of needed something. Brittany was excited. She had signed up for classes. She had a little job. She was set. She's murdered, and she is sexually assaulted and strangled, and she had been beat up a little bit, like thrown against the wall and things like that. Dr. Zingman is intelligent, and she's a calming type person. Like, even when you're talking to her, maybe trying to advocate, she has a way of calming you, just the way she speaks. It's very cadence-driven and calm and, you know, soothing kind of. But she is not turning this thing loose, and she's not going to accept no, and she's not going to accept the cold case. She's just not. Every single time she hears about a new technique or tool or invention, she seeks it out and tells law enforcement. We all know about this. So one of the first things she tried was going through Parabon and doing the phenotyping. They did that. They generated a composite. Baby, she took that composite and slapped it on the hood of her car. And she drove across the country with this man's face on her car, basically saying, y'all know this guy? Y'all seen this guy? And,
perfect.
And she didn't, oh, my God. And she didn't just pull up the stadiums of 80,000 people, y'all. She did this one person at a time. People would look at her at red lights, and she'd go, she'd point to the hood. Do you know him? She'd point to the side. This is my child. I rode with her for a little distance. I was gobsmacked by the number of people that would come up to her, talk to her, ask her questions, want to know about Brittany, who's on the hood of the car. Well, then tragically, we find out, yes, that was generated, but it was somebody that was known to be in the apartment, a friend. It was not the suspect. So then we're like, oh, no, she is just so disheartened. And, you know, here she spent all this time with this person, I think, on, I don't know, maybe two different cars, driving 10,000, 20,000 miles. So then she learns about the MBAT. She learns about Othram. She learns about Jared Bradley. And, I mean, just all these different tremendous people, Francine Bardol. Everybody's trying to help her. Everybody's trying to walk law enforcement through what is the most probative. What can we go back and test? What can we go back and look at? Where this case sits real sinister for people, Brittany's apartment, if you think of it like a flower, there's four apartments that have this little tiny centerpiece where they connect. On the outside, there's like this walkway. It's almost like how prisons are built. A handyman could be in that little space behind each apartment checking on pipes or electricity or whatever they're doing, without having to enter somebody's apartment. So it sounds like a great thing. It's less intrusive. The problem is, and this is something Dr. Zingman and Brittany had no real understanding of, there was a trap door in her closet where somebody that was behind there could enter any of the four apartments with no forced entry and perhaps lay in wait. So now
wow.
You have people connected to her. They were in her class. Did they stalk her? She had a job. Did they stalk her? She's a single girl coming in and out of an apartment. Even somebody in another apartment could watch her if they knew about that entryway because they've lived there a while. If they were a handyman, if they were a former handyman that had been fired, there's all kind of people that would know that, people that they have to bring in from the outside to work on the roof or work on the electricity. That wouldn't be their handyman doing that, but a you know, third party, fourth party. So the suspects are pretty wide. And again, Dr. Zeman is right now driving across the country, and she is headed to CrimeCon. So she'll be there with us next week.
Well, please extend our olive branch and tell her we're here if we can help in any way, especially have her on the show, talk about Brittany and the case.
Mm-hmm.
We're happy to do that.
I will absolutely do it.
She reached out. She knows what, just like Beth,
mm-hmm.
and Melissa Baum and Julian
yep.
Nichols. Julian Nichols will be on our show October 9th. These women, and their husbands and the fathers and all the family members, they just
yeah.
want accountability and justice for their murdered children, their missing children. And I think that law enforcement and the judicial system and prosecutors across this country need to remember who the victims are in the
mm-hmm.
cases. And they, not the perpetrators, deserve to be heard. And no one should judge the parents of a missing child or a murdered child. Never, ever, ever judge them with how much time and energy they spend. We have a case out here on Jamie Grissom, a serial murderer, Warren Forrest. Star Laura, her sister went missing at 16 years old in 1971.
Mm-hmm.
And he is known to have killed as many as 15 or 16 women, young girls. And we went through his trial in January for another murder. During that same time, they believe Jamie Grissom was his first victim. And I can tell you, Star Laura is not giving up, and she has worked since 1971 fighting the good fight. And so you have to.
Yep.
You just have to. You know, how can you stop and how do you give up on your missing loved one?
And, you
or
know,
your murdered loved one.
I have watched Beth reach out to other families, Gabby Petito's being one, and I have watched Susan Levy do the same thing. I've
mm-hmm.
watched tons of families reach out because they now have this playbook, so to speak, and are so willing to share it. And, you know, there's different acceptance. There's different ways of fighting. There's different ways to get justice. And again, there's personalities where somebody may not know even how to reach 3,000 people. Call Beth. She will help you do it. She will stand next to you to do it. So, you know, there's all kind of ways. You know, call me, call y'all, call somebody. We will help you. So I just
Definitely.
Appreciate what y'all are doing. And I appreciate y'all having me
and
on
I appreciate
so
you, too. You and I appeared on Nancy together years ago. So, and I know that you and I both know Steph Watts. And,
oh, sure.
And so,
love him.
Yeah, I love Steph. He's such a character.
You know,
but
that's another thing. Steph can be your advocate. Give him the story and turn him loose, baby. I mean, there are people that can turn your story into the story and get people's attention and other people's talent that maybe can help and get something done. But, yeah, I adore him. Yeah, absolutely.
Definitely. Just a reminder to all of those listening, please share this podcast. Share Max's links. You can find them on our page as well. Reminder, September 25th is National Day of Remembrance for Murdered Victims. October 9th, we will have Cara Nichols, mom and dad, Julia and Paul Nichols, speaking out and letting them loose, after a decade of keeping quiet, and now that their daughter's murderer has been prosecuted, we will be talking a lot about Carr's case. Any last thoughts, Mac?
The only thing I will tell you is, you know, today is September the 11th, and if anybody wants to listen to my podcast, Zone 7, I do a special about how wonderful the people were in Gander, Newfoundland, Canada, to my sister who was diverted there when I was headed to the Pentagon. So it's a little different take on September 11th. It's really all about love wins.
Definitely. This is Dr. Mathis, and I just want to say to you, Mac, thank you, thank you, thank you for all that you do. Thank you for being on our podcast. I'm a fan. I love who you are, what you do for our world, and for, you know, helping the family members of missing and murdered individuals. And I would love for you to come back at another time and be on our show again.
Anytime. And I will tell you, I've been a huge fan of y'all's, and, you know, the way that y'all approach everything and the way that y'all are just all about, let's help as many as we can, every way we can. I mean, that's what we should all be doing. So I am a huge fan of y'all's as well, and I respect everything y'all are about. So I appreciate you.
Thank you.
Well, you have a wonderful time in Orlando. And we will be back in touch, and we are now going to close in memory of all the people that lost a loved one, all the people that have lost their lives, September 11th. Good night, everyone.